Okay, today is Thursday, June 12th, 2014, and this is Karen Brewster here with Dave Klein at his home in Fairbanks, Alaska, and we're continuing with where we left off last week, where we were talking about the Cooperative Wildlife Unit, and you're starting there, and I thought we'd step back a little bit to how the cooperative unit got started and who was there before you.
Okay, I'll do that. And am I coming through okay?
Yep.
And I'm going to be correcting your terminology frequently because
yes.
It's
confusing.
It's a log handle.
Yes.
The Alaska Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit. And then it became the Alaska Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit.
Well, I was careful not to say fish because I knew that came later.
Right, yep.
But I left out the research part.
I noticed that. That's why
it is. It's a long label. And also, as you talk about it more and more, it just becomes the unit.
Well,
or the cooperative, or the wildlife unit, or something. So
it's
good to...
Some of them have the unit, but it frequently is referred to as the co-op.
Oh, okay.
And neither of those are restricted to the Alaska Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit. Like, we get the Cooperative Extension Service,
right.
And then you have units within geophysics and stuff
right.
like that.
But the fact that it's such a long title,
yeah.
it makes sense that we all
yeah.
shorten it. And I try very hard to not put fish in there.
And that was in, I can get this in now, but that is, I don't like acronyms. Yet they become more and more, and so many times, you know, students making a presentation, and if it's not someone in your own unit, you don't have a clue what they're talking about.
Right.
And they assume, because they're used to using a shortcut. Yeah.
So, yes, I agree. I try not to use the shortcuts, but...
Right.
That word is so long.
I know it is, and if you have to use it several times in two or three
right.
sentences, that's
And I'm also, at this stage, being very careful to not say Institute of Arctic Biology or IAB, because I know that came later, and we'll get to that later.
Right.
So I have at least learned that there's a difference.
Well, there's a difference, and there's some history that's complicated there, but it's good to we can talk about that
when we get to that time, because that comes chronologically a little bit later. So what happened with how did the Alaska Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, or maybe then it was just University of Alaska, get started?
It had just become a university. It was about 2 years before that. It was Alaska College of Mining and Agriculture, or something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
And maybe agricultural science, but even that was probably later. Yeah.
So when did the Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit begin?
Officially, it was founded in 1950 here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. In Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, at that time, in college, it was called.
College Alaska.
Because the post office was in college.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And it was a national program that was voted on by Congress and approved by Congress. It could occur at land-grant universities in the various states. So there's only one land-grant university per state, and not every state has them, but most states do now. And they were handling usually agricultural programs
mm-hmm.
At land grant in those days. This one, as I pointed out just earlier, was a College of Mining and Agricultural Science. Now, it seems strange that mining, okay, because that was a big deal for interior Alaska at that time, was gold mining. And there had been pretty good agricultural development for the mining community, because the cost of shipping any food up was, not only took months but to get here, but the cost was huge. if you could grow a garden, that would help. So there was the university, and there was a, had been, I think, even before the university was formed, a federal government and agricultural research station.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that was just out on a road that only went a few miles beyond the university, and that was a more traditional dairy and poultry and pork, but they did a lot of work with reindeer and muskoxen, and did some crossbreeding with mountain sheep and domestic sheep, and also with cattle and yak. And some of this is, there's usually reports in the archives of Rasmussen,
right,
where there's all of this federal agency stuff. And these are very interesting stuff to go through.
Yeah.
And virtually all those crossbreeding and with wildlife species stopped when Congress said, learn that they were trying to cross these animals. Why don't you stick with cows and horses and moose? So it's hard to convince people in Congress about this. Anyway, the wildlife unit was established because to be cooperative between the federal government and the state. Well, Alaska wasn't a state then, but it was a territory. And so technically it was, you know, not quite in line with the other states, but it was, there was statehood movement was underway, and why should attitude was, you know, the now we've got a university getting started, and we can't discriminate just because we're not a state yet, that we should be able to do this. And so that was approved, that and there was a, the nationally, it was the understood that the Fish and Wildlife Service would provide a salary for the wildlife unit leader, and one person, no assistants, leaders, others, and also the university would provide a facilities office and a secretary, and so they would provide a budget, a university budget, for operation of the office. And so that meant a secretary and a receptionist and whatever, and keeping records and helping write reports and what. And then then it was the Alaska Department of Fish and Game that was a participant here, and they contributed a lump sum amount to, and it said, I think, that it should be used primarily for training of students. So it could be used as a stipend for students, or possibly for the student research. If it was doing research for a thesis, it might be able to do that. But it wasn't. In the first, at the beginning, it was a small amount, but of course stipends were very small too.
Well, but at the beginning in 1950, was there Alaska Department of Fish and Game? Because we were a territory still.
That's true. There wasn't. So it was. It was through the federal. What was the functioning management of wildlife? Was who paid for it? The federal government did, through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska. So they had employed biologists that were doing studies on this. Main species like caribou, moose, and some on a few other species, and then the wildlife unit frequently got in-kind support for students that were doing studies that for these biologists. And they might get some aircraft time or be used. They get good experience working as a field technic, but they might be part of their thesis project too. So, and we were used, and we got a little pay, I think, as students from manning checking station during the hunting season, mm-hmm. which was training primarily, but they paid a little bit.
So with the beginning of the unit, it was Fish and Wildlife that was giving that student stipend?
Yes, but technically the management of, when it came to, there were game wardens that were Fish and Wildlife Service, paid by Fish and Wildlife Service, and they were the wildlife enforcement people, and then there were also predator and rodent control people, Fish and Wildlife Service. And then there was the regulations somewhat comparable to a Board of Game. Mm-hmm. There were a panel of four or five senior citizens who were appointed. I think it was created, and there was a, I don't know whether the territorial governor played a role in that or not, but it, once it was created, then replacements, and they were pretty much there for life, and unless they wanted to time off or they got sick or something, and they were more senior old-timers had been, say, registered guides mm-hmm. and outfitters, and that trappers or fur, one was a fur buyer, I remember, from Nome, and there was one was a lawyer from Fairbanks who was a fisherman, and so he was very interested in a hunter. Virtually mm-hmm. everyone was a hunter then, and then there was one was from Southeast Alaska who had been a guide, and then he had a business of fish processing cannery, a small one, mm-hmm. and but he was noted for the time that he was a hunter and guide, and he'd fished commercially as well.
So somebody like a market hunter, like Frank Glazer, might have been?
Well, at that time, the market hunting was no longer allowed in Alaska, okay. But Frank Glazer was employed by that Fish and Wildlife Service. Several different categories. One was, he was like a technician, a high-level technician. He didn't have advanced degrees, and neither did the game wardens. But he had a lot of experience, and he had been a trapper on his own, and trapped wolves as well as other creatures and dog musher, and a lot of experience, and. At that time, when I was a student, a graduate student, he had sort of retired from living in the bush. He was in his 60s, I think, and he was employed by the university as a night watchman.
Oh.
And he'd go around and check locks on doors. And in the summertime, we had an opportunity to talk with him. He was a very talkative guy.
I'm sure.
We'd be sitting, and a nice day, and when we were in from the field ourselves, and we ate in the dorm then, good, and at a special rate for per meal or something, and that was pretty reasonable. And we'd sit out on the front steps of the dorm, and I think it was the main dorm, and that time there was a Hess Hall, a women's dorm, was the only concrete building. It wasn't the only one, but it was one of the few. And these were wooden dorms. And the first year, I lived in, had rooms in old Quonset huts that had been put there during the military time. And then second year, we moved into the old dorm, the main dorm, I think the cafeteria was downstairs there. And so I'd sit there, and when Frank would come doing his rounds, he couldn't resist stopping and talking, and we wanted him to stop and talk. And he told us his wonderful stories. And us wildlifers who thought we were learning the real, first to learn the real truth about wildlife, we thought he might be stretching some of these, that he was just a good storyteller. And but we learned over time that, oh, he was only telling you a little of all of these amazing things that happened in his life. But he was a very friendly guy, and so we appreciated the chance to talk with him and get to know him a little. And he wasn't a very big guy, and he wore a felt hat most of the time. And so he had this characteristic walk that you could identify from a distance.
Yeah, that's neat.
So at any rate, then there was one other organization involved in the establishment of the wildlife units, and that was the Wildlife Management Institute. Now, that was a private organization, and you could call it a sort of like a foundation. They had money coming in from membership, and they also got money from sporting arms and ammunition.
Taxes, you mean, or?
No. They were good for lobbying on fishing and hunting activities. This was before the Federal Aid and Wildlife Restoration Law was passed that took the taxes.
Okay.
So there were, in those days, there were not taxes on firearms and ammunition. So the Wildlife Management Institute, based in Washington, D.C., but they're very much involved in lobbying for education in these land-grant universities and for the establishment of the wildlife units. So they were, when we'd have annual meetings in Alaska, or later on when they had enough money to go to meetings, they would be present and would have some influence in shaping how the units are going to be consistent with the legislation, but also to speak up for the interests of the units in the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was it's a complicated program with all of these cooperators, and that's sort of central for the program, is the cooperation with state and federal. Whereas then, as now, state legislatures were often cutting budgets, and they didn't like the idea that federal government had so much influence within their university systems. And on the other hand, they liked the money coming in.
Right.
And it was not state money and not state taxpayer money. So the Wildlife Management Institute, these were respected people. Frequently they were senior biologists with the Fish and Wildlife Service or with other state agencies, and who had retired, and maybe in their 50s, late 50s, early 60s, and they had some experience probably lobbying for state interests in general. So they played an important role, and they were highly respected, and for the Alaska unit, they were important in justifying establishing a wildlife unit at the university here in Alaska. So that part of the agreement with the university was, in addition to the funding part of it, was the university was establishing this graduate program in wildlife and wildlife ecology and management, And yet, the unit leader was technically the, he was a member of the faculty that was in of the university faculty, mm-hmm. as well as, even though he wasn't getting a salary from them, he or she would, and it was just he in those days, but they would be expected to do some teaching, but mostly at the graduate level, and expected to advise the students. The students that were working on a master's degree, at the, just master's at the beginning, they were doing their degree technically through the university department, mm-hmm. of biology and wildlife was what it was mostly, mm-hmm. over that time, although the title changed a few times. And so then the advising, you were really working for the university system, but also for the cooperative unit system.
But so the university starting to get this program going, graduate program going in wildlife, they kind of got a free faculty person.
Well, that's where, in this initial agreement, the university agreed to hire a professor for wildlife, to teach the wildlife courses, in addition to the unit leader.
Right.
Because the unit leader was only a part-time teacher, really, because he had all these other responsibilities. So,
right, but because they were also a faculty person, the university got a faculty person to help with teaching students, but they didn't have to pay that person. So they kind of got
the unit leader.
Right. The university hired the faculty to teach, and then they got this kind of free unit leader to do courses for free.
But they got a program.
Right.
Yeah.
They built a program.
And so the first unit leader was Neil Hosley, who was a senior. He had been with the state wildlife organization. I think it was Michigan, and he'd done some work. And published some good papers on moose ecology, I think, and food habits and what. And so he was hired, and he might have had some experience starting to teach at a university back in Michigan. I'm not sure about that. So he, his wife and young son came, and he took that position. And so he was the one that I corresponded with in probably in as early as the end of calendar year 1950, right after it was established, because I heard it had been established. I was a student then doing undergraduate work at the University of Connecticut. And I, after having spent a year in Alaska, I was eager to come back.
Right. So when you came as a student to work on your master's, Neil Hosley was the unit leader.
Well, not technically, because he was the unit leader up until he was asked to be dean of students by the university president, and at that time, and then and that was the first president, I guess, and maybe it had to be approved by the regents, probably, because it was a new position.
So when did he switch to become the dean?
I think it was probably in early 1951.
Oh, okay.
So it would be in the spring semester of 1951. And so that was, and I graduated at the end of that 1951 back in Connecticut.
Right.
So then when he was moved into that position, that opened up the co-op unit leader position, and then the man that had been hired to be the one wildlife teacher was John Buckley. He had a PhD from the University of Newark at Syracuse.
Mm-hmm.
And he had pretty good experience, and had maybe, I think, had already had a position there. But he was hired and taught for a short time. And so then...
So he became the... Buckley became the new unit leader.
He became the new unit leader. Hosley continued to teach a few courses as the dean of students, and I took a course or two from him.
How do you spell Hosley?
H-O-S-L-E-Y, I'm pretty sure.
H-O-S-L-E-Y, okay.
And so then, to replace the position that John Buckley moved out of, the wildlife management professor, that was, they hired Jim Reardon.
Okay.
And then, shortly after that, I think there was, Buckley was working, his research interests were furbears and wetlands, and so they were starting research with students out at Minto Flats because it wasn't too far away. And the focus there was starting on furbears in general, but not all in that area. But furs was very important in the economy of Alaska at that time. So a lot of the first students were doing theses on beavers, marten, mink, and that was about it on those beginning times. And but then the wetlands, especially Minto Lakes, had a lot of waterfowl, and the Fish and Wildlife Service was responsible for migratory bird work. And so I'm not sure how the funding would work, but then they hired another faculty member, and that was Bryna Kessel. Mm-hmm. And she had done her PhD at Cornell University. And so she came. She was just fresh with a PhD.
Right, and she was an trained ornithologist, wasn't she?
Yeah, he was a trained ornithologist, and she had high recommendations and had really good experience. And so she taught ornithology. She taught some of the other courses as well, and but she also was a key person because students then could work on waterfowl projects and in conjunction with the fur bearer projects sometimes, or at least at Minto Lakes. Mm-hmm. And then Buckley then was working with her on some of the waterfowl work, as well as she would assist on some of the fur bearer stuff,
right,
or with the students. So that was a pretty good program. And it didn't quite fit my interests when I came. And Hosley, when he accepted me, and I'd had this, already had experience in Alaska, which was unlike other students coming in from outside. From other states.
Right.
They didn't have experience. So then, plus that he found me a job after I graduated in Connecticut, and he said, I said, if I could get a job, that would be great in Alaska.
Is that when you worked at the Moose Range in Kenai?
Yeah.
Before you started school, yeah.
So he had contacted the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they needed the refuge manager at Kenai. Enough money to support one field assistant for the whole refuge and for a summer. And so he said they would hire me on Hosley's recommendation.
And then so Buckley was the unit leader until you came, or there was somebody in between? Because you said he started around 51.
I came in 51.
No, Buckley was the unit, the Cooperative Wildlife Unit Leader, when you were a student, so in 1951, and then you became the unit leader, what, 61?
Oh, in the interim, under Buckley, I did a study on mountain goats.
Right, but I'm trying to think, the administration of the Cooperative Wildlife Unit, Buckley was the unit leader, then who came after him?
Okay. That came after I left and graduated.
Right.
And so then the next unit leader I'm pretty sure was Bob Scott. Now, the reason for Bob Scott was a biologist working for the Fish and Wildlife Service doing sheep studies, and...
Oh, he's the guy you worked so closely with.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
So, and Bob Scott was, he was very much a, he had a master's degree from Oregon State in wildlife, which was kind of unique. And he had been a pilot in the war. And so he was employed here to work with the Fish and Wildlife Service and worked on mountain sheep primarily, but he worked, you know, work on everything because they had to team together on various projects. But that was his responsibility. So the reason that position opened again was John Buckley was recognized as an outstanding wildlife person, and they and he was good at understanding conservation issues and political issues related to conservation nationwide. And so he was, I think the Wildlife Management Institute had been lobbying the president at that time to establish a position as advisor to the president as in ecology.
The advisor to the U.S. president?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
So
wow.
It was a position, I'm not sure, it was within the presidential administration.
Wow.
And this was the first time, I think, and they looked around the country, and Buckley was sort of nominated for it. So he was already employed by the Fish and Wildlife Service. So he went through a transfer program and mm-hmm. and went there, but it was under the president rather than being...
Yeah, I've never heard of that, an advisor on ecology. Wow.
Yeah.
How advanced.
It was good. But it was... And they refer to him probably as fish and game and all that, too.
Right. So he left, and then Bob Scott became the unit leader?
Bob Scott became the unit leader, and he continued with his focus, but he was much broader then because he was covering... And Bob was perhaps one of the best qualified in terms of education, training, and experience and interest to be a unit leader where you dealt with a broad subject area, because it was becoming obvious in the unit that there were studies that were needed by the Fish and Game and the territory of Alaska that went beyond just traditional a big huntable mm-hmm. terrestrial wildlife or trapping furs or waterfowl management. So then students came and they had potential funding, because you always had to look for funding, because we usually the stipend money wasn't enough to mm-hmm. for more than about 3 students a year. And so they could support more if they could get more money. And there was a demand by the federal agencies. And the territorial legislature decided they should have, rather than the Fish and Wildlife Service be responsible for fish management in Alaska, which at that time included both marine fish within territorial waters and freshwater fish, and the other agencies like the Forest Service, they didn't have any biologists, period, let alone salmon people right. working with anadromous fish. But there was also a lot of fishing, commercial fishing along the coast, mainly commercial, some sport fishing, but mainly commercial fishing. And then when there was a problem, like what do you do if there's a problem with with bears. Who's going to deal with it? Well, the Fish and Wildlife had people that could biologists, but then there would be what happens when seals are taking fish out of their gill nets and at the mouth of rivers where they were legal to. In southeast, that would be the Sakin River and mm-hmm. the Taku River, and then also the Copper River, and the fishermen wanted the seals killed, and sometimes they would convince the legislature, state legislature, that they should put a bounty on the seals, and there was beginning pressure to. Well, what about the seals? I mean, they're mostly not doing this year-round. It's just when the salmon are coming up. And they're part of a system, and the sea lions the same way. Mm-hmm. And these are valuable animals. And, on the one hand, we protected the fur seals, which were almost the same as sea lions and evolutionarily, but it was because of the value of the furs. It can't just draw the conclusion because they eat fish, they're bad, and they should be killed. That didn't make sense. Even though, and especially when for the marine mammals, I mean, some of the guided guides and outfitters, they were mainly. The hunters are coming from some international, but from the lower 48, and who wanted to hunt big trophy animals. So that would be moose and big trophy mountain sheep.
Bears.
And big brown bears. And but was it legal for those hunters to shoot, say, big sea lions and the things? Well, it was obvious we didn't know enough about these animals that were big rookeries. And so some of the students that were coming to the unit wanted to work on marine mammals, or there was money available. Yeah, it was like money available to support a student, whereas there was no fish and wildlife biologists that were trained to work there. Well, why not let students do a research, and it would only cost them, $10,000 or $15,000, and versus hiring someone would be huge. And
right.
They didn't have the budgets to do it that way, but they could do this. So that when by the time I came, there were students has already started that were working on seals out of an island south of Kodiak, hair seals, and we had, when I was there, we recruited a Swedish student to work, and he worked on sea lions in Prince William Sound on a rookery there that had been worked on a little bit by a new program that had been started. It was like the Territorial Department of Fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the precursor to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. But there were a lot of these research questions that related to salmon and halibut and other very valuable commercial fish. And we needed more information about these marine mammals as well. And to let all of those. There were some studies of marine birds, too, mm-hmm. at the same time. Sometimes they were coordinated with the marine mammals because they could work in the same, those two yeah. students work in the same area.
But so your point being is that as the wildlife unit progressed, that the wildlife management issues and research was becoming more varied and more complicated, and the unit was going along with it. The research being done there and the faculty were becoming more broad.
Right.
And so after Bob Scott.
Okay, then the Bob Scott thing was he was having some difficulties.
Oh, he was right. He had some personal issues you mentioned before. Yeah.
Personal issues and including he was had a very unfortunate family situation. A son who had mental problems and schizophrenic, and then the daughter got polio and became a cripple.
So he left the position, and who took over for him?
When he left, it kind of, they thought they had this wonderful unit leader. They did. But then when he left, there was a vacancy, and they were able to get, you know, they had asked somebody like Fred Dean to be acting to sign deals, and they would, students and have, would, and other faculty would help put things together and to meet the reporting deadlines. But he was still a full-time teacher, and spending, he didn't have time to do much with that. It was just a figurehead. And then they then were able to get co-op unit leaders from other states to come up. A couple of them came up and on a short-term basis to help out and keep things going. Mm-hmm. And I think Jim Lindsay was from Pennsylvania, I think. Anyway, he was top-notch, and he loved it here. But so then they tried to talk him into transferring, and his wife didn't want to come up because he had family and everything in Pennsylvania, and he liked Pennsylvania, but so he couldn't come. So after his term was up, there may have been another person for a short time, but they were trying to recruit somebody. By this time, I was in, I'd finished pretty much finished my dissertation research for the PhD based on work on dairy ecology in Southeast Alaska, and had moved back, and they offered me a job in Juneau as coordinator for the Federal Aid and Wildlife Restoration program.
That was about 1960, 61, somewhere in there?
That was in 61 that we came back to Juneau and started, I guess, in the state fiscal year started on July 1, and then we got back in time to start that. And so then I was doing that job while I had a couple of weeks of field work that I was able to do on the islands and out of Petersburg, but I was also full-time putting together and budgeting and managing the Federal Aid and Wildlife Restoration Program. That meant some oversight on all of those programs throughout the state, mostly out of Fairbanks and Anchorage office, and all the studies on moose and caribou and bear, and some on the Kodiak and the Fognac. Mm-hmm. And so I get to travel around a bit and get to work and see who get out in the field at least. And some of the biologists I knew because they were fellow students, but not all of them. And so then, you know, our job was to provide guidance in the science and the setups and the program, and to be sure they understood how to work within the budget that was available, or maybe argue for a bigger budget, but it all had to fit in together, their priorities. And so it was good training for me, experience. But then I was approached probably in the beginning of 1960, it's probably about the end of the calendar year, 1961, as to they had looked at all of the potential candidates This is the Washington Co-op Unit staff and administrative staff, and they said they wanted to hire me if I was available to be a unit leader. Well, you know, it came out of the blue, and I thought that certainly would be my long-term goal.
Yeah.
But I realized those things just don't happen, and I thought it would be down the road many years before I could qualify or before I could move into that position and have experience. But things happened fast then, because after statehood and education, people needed more education, and I was getting it, and I had good experience in Southeast with the deer ecology as well as management, and with my own research that I was doing there that was being supported by the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Yeah, you certainly were in the right place at the right time and had the right experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure.
But I also had a wife and two kids. And some debt incurred in going to University of British Columbia.
Right.
Because my wife had been a teacher in Petersburg, and we had young kids, she had to take...
Right.
We couldn't teach any longer, and that was worked out well. But we didn't have much income. We saved, earned vacation time and piled that up, which was good. And then would come back in the summer and work for the Fish and Game after statehood, because they had become a state then in 59. So
you don't happen to remember the years when all these different people we just talked about were unit leaders, do you?
No, but I have a booklet in my office.
Okay.
It has all
okay.
that in there.
Because that's a great
progression. Yeah, I better make a note of these things because I know where that book is.
When you came in 62, there hadn't been an actual unit leader. There was sort of this acting and temporary...
Yeah, Scott was... in and out, and I met with him, and he was the guy I interacted with, and I know him so well and liked him very much. He was still taking responsibility for the things that, and then he had to move himself and family back
okay.
there, and so
he was still around to kind of help you transition.
Yeah,
but the general day-to-day management and administration had been being done by these
But I people. Had the advantage of knowing the other faculty members, like Brian Akessel, Jim Ridden, and Hosley, mm-hmm. and those. And Hosley, he was still
around.
He was still very supportive of the unit and doing what he could. And
right. Well, you knew the other faculty because you'd been a student here and you'd been interacting with
And it was
them.
Hosley, I think, was one of those people who highly recommended me for that position.
Uh-huh. Okay. While you're writing that down, I can cough.
Sure.
So once you came and became the cooperative wildlife unit leader in 1962.
Yeah.
I guess my first question is, how does the unit operate? What was the relationship like between the unit leader who was a Fish and Wildlife Service employee versus these faculty who were
okay.
university employees. How did that, did it work? Did it not work?
Examples? That was one of the more complex aspects of the unit leaders, the unit position and the role of the unit leader. And frankly, it varied a lot to other states where units occurred. And we would meet annually, so I was able to, get a feeling for other units, and I even started some exchange program where I got more familiar. But
we talked about that last time.
But here at UAF, or University of Alaska at the time, and the co-op unit. According to the Memorandum of Understanding, at all of these units, faculty member is the unit leader is a faculty member and has to go through the same procedure of peer review and advancement to get moved from assistant professor to associate professor to full professor. However, it's different, and because there's no salary involved.
Mm-hmm.
But how you manage this relationship from the university perspective was all important, because they wanted you to, they appreciated that you were another faculty member, but it was always some other faculty kind of resented the fact that you had year-round funding salary, whereas other faculty usually had 9-month salary. But you also had this commitment that I worked in the summer for that money to keep the unit going, to advise graduate students, because most of them were thus age, they weren't taking on graduate students mm-hmm. as advisees because they weren't being paid to do that.
Oh.
They might be teaching a course that would be appropriate for the graduate program, but unless they were doing research of some kind and they had the research grant paid for their salary in the summer. Well, that at those days, it wasn't happening that way. It wasn't National Science Foundation and other federal agencies that would be providing the funding. It was mostly sometimes through Seder or through federal agencies that maybe they would... And they frequently wouldn't provide salary money for professors, so.
They provided for students.
They would provide some funding for a student that they would advise. In the summertime, they were just, if they were around and not on vacation or someplace because they weren't on salary, they might they'd volunteer their time to, and they were good about advising, but most of the summer was when most of the students were in the field, and so they would get them ready to go in the field, but then I would assume, the unit leader would assume some responsibility mm-hmm. for those students.
So if a faculty member had a 9-month contract and they didn't get paid in the summer, did they not go do research and field work in the summer? They just were on vacation? And
no, this was a source point with them, and justifiably, because the university state budget, it's a salary, that was the state legislature had to approve, and the university president had a hard time getting enough money to have the courses taught that would mm-hmm. need to be taught, let alone pay for them in the summer. So what would they do in the summer?
Yeah.
They didn't have specific research projects. Some of them did, but they usually worked that out with agencies like the Fish and Wildlife or Forest Service or something.
Or what I was thinking is they were doing their summer research just on their own time.
Yeah.
They weren't getting paid for it.
Some were doing that for sure.
Because how would you progress as a faculty member where you have to get tenure, you have to be doing research, you have to be producing.
In those days,
you have to do field work.
No, that was a problem. There was a problem in the administrative structure of the university, because the research institutes were not part of not tied to the departments, the academic departments. So it was like when they started building the research institutes up on the West Ridge, then there were no courses taught up there. And so if any of the faculty who were hired for the research institute as research faculty, in few cases, they would also be teaching. But in most cases, they didn't have a split appointment with the academic departments.
So in those days, if you were a, for example, a wildlife faculty member, your job was just to teach. You didn't have to do research to get tenure in advance?
That's correct.
Oh, okay.
If you did research, you would probably be a plus, but it was not required.
Oh, okay.
And so it was people in the sciences that were in this awkward position because some of them were doing research but weren't getting paid to do it in the summertime.
Right.
Whereas in the humanities, they went and did something else in the summer. Took another job someplace, mm-hmm. which was common. You know, go work in the library or downtown or whatever they could find, or leave and visit family. That was also
right.
But if while they were out, they might find some job if it was all summer long.
But it's interesting because now the university structure. Faculty still only get 9 months' salary, but they still work in the summertime. They don't go on vacation. They're still doing research or writing or whatever, and they're usually based on grants or something. They find ways to...
That's in the humanities, that's true. But in sciences, that's harder to do that because if it's field research or something, or geophysics, or that... working on glaciation or volcanism. I mean, it's really hard to carry on, and especially if you got a family.
Right, but it seems that nowadays the faculty who they're teaching and they have to do research, they find grants to fund their research so that they're not just volunteering their time to do research. That seems to be different.
Nowadays... if you're doing research and it's funded through the, say, National NIH, National Institute of Health, or the National Science Foundation, or other organizations, funding agencies, you write a proposal for the kind of work you're going to do, and then if you can't do it all yourself, you can write in for a graduate student support.
Mm-hmm.
But you also, if you're going to be working in more than during the academic year, and you, in fact, even if you are, because you don't have time to do research if you're a full-time teacher.
Right.
So you try to get funding to cover your summer. And if you're doing top-notch research and you've got two or three postdocs or something working with you, then you can write in your summer salary for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So then what you're literally buying out of, because the money, a certain percentage of that overhead and stuff
right.
goes into the operation of the program. So this works well now, but it didn't work well then when the institutes were separate from the departments.
Mm.
And the departments... were mostly only supported by the state, and the academic departments. And the research institutes were largely supported by federal agencies.
And those employees of the research institute tended not to teach courses very often.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I didn't realize that this current structure it was different than... what it was back in the earlier days.
There was a big transition that came about, and I don't know the exact dates, but then I don't know whether we had moved to a statewide, I think we'd moved to a statewide system. So there was politics involved to some extent because Anchorage campus came into being. And they didn't have any research institutes, and they were then being expected to teach in some of these areas. And then Fairbanks had all the research institutes. They even had the Business and Economic Social Research Institute
right.
here.
Oh, that was here. That's right. That was here for a while.
And one of the reasons it went to Anchorage was they were, you know, had good academic programs there, and it seemed like as good place to be, that better place to be than on this campus. But we all had these physical and biological sciences institutes that were doing well, and they didn't have those kind of things down in Anchorage. So it was often, you know, Anchorage campus versus Fairbanks campus budgeting, and how much independence they had, or whether for a while they didn't. They were pretty independent, and they didn't. They're continuing to try to get programs similar so that students can move back and forth, and it's making progress. And the present head of the system, Gamble is his name, is emphasizing that, and the two chancellors are sort of working in that direction too.
But it is interesting, I didn't realize in the earlier period that, you know, you're talking about in the 60s here, that faculty who were teaching courses were not also required to do research to get tenure.
No, it came about sometime. Well, first place, when this early time when I first came, there was no tenure.
Oh, okay.
There were no sabbatical leaves. There was a teacher had a 2-year, a professor had a 2-year contract, and every 2 years that was reviewed. And if you were doing a good job, you got a favorable review, and the deans played a big process, and not just, and then the president of the system, and the peer concept of peer review was, you know, it was like a sandbox because you're overridden by the department head and the deans. So they would, you know, people's contracts would be, they couldn't terminate it without giving you 1 year of probation, a 2-year contract. So that's the closest thing to tenure it was. And then there was, if you were a brand new professor, assistant professor, you had a 1-year contract, and you had to have a favorable, a very favorable review after that year, or you wouldn't get a permanent, a 2-year contract. You wouldn't become permanent. They might give you a second year on probation, and then if you didn't stack up, you were done, and they recruited someone else. And that happened a lot in department, where the English department, for example, and they would judge by publications that they were putting out rather than by whether they're teaching properly. And I, as a young faculty member, believing in, I mean, I tried to behave like a faculty member, but the point was, I was selected to the faculty council, which was strictly advisory to the president. But it was a sandbox for us people. And we'd have a meeting of faculty council and say, well, why won't the president consider changing the system to provide tenure? And well, all of that had to go through, of course, the regents and things like that. And we weren't the only state university in this position. It was this boom in education after the Second World War that brought all this on, especially at state universities. There was, when there was an arbitrary dismissal, there was no place to go. There's no grievance committee or anything like that. That was it. So there still is this organization of Association of University Professors, I think. And so a chapter started in UAF. I was one of the, I don't know whether I was a charter member, but I was close to that. And then I got elected president of it. One reason they wanted me to be president Walt Van Ness and people like that were young firebrands, and I was a bit that way, and Dale Guthrie and stuff, and so then when there was a grievance, they came to us. Well, we weren't part of the university system. That wasn't part of the university system, but the members were all part of it, except mm-hmm. I was a federal employee. So technically, they couldn't touch me, but of course they could touch me because all they had to do was report that I wasn't doing my job well from the university standpoint, and they could put in their requests. I was protected through the federal merit system, which was being upgraded and was becoming quite good, comparable to a peer review at university level. So I had these two systems. So for my salary and advancement was based on my submitting every so many years. You had to submit this long thing about everything you did, and then my boss in Washington had to check with the university and find out if what I said was legitimate. But I had to put all my publications and things down. And yeah, then they would recommend to the merit system panel and within the Fish and Wildlife Advancement. And yeah, it worked well. I hated to do those things. It was just like the going up for tenure here.
Right.
It's the same kind of thing. But I had to do something similar for advancement, but not really, because it usually came from the department head said, I'll put together this, and because I think you should be getting advanced, like Beiner Kessel, for example. Well, it was one time, and that was before the Firecracker Boys, but when Bryna was department head. But mostly, she was, you know, we weren't used to women being in an administrative position. For me, I adapted well. From the beginning, I had a lot of respect for Bryna because he was a good teacher and a good academic and was doing wonderful work in bird work. But there was no people at higher levels like deans that were women in those mm-hmm. days. And it was like, they'll never get there, that kind of attitude, you know. And some of faculty in biology and wildlife who accepted her is still, you know, I don't like the idea of working for a woman. I mean, it was that kind of a mentality. And some of them were good people that I liked, but they would acknowledge her doing good work, but didn't like this idea of working for a woman. And it was, you know, for a lot of us, we'd come out of the military, and we never had any women over us in the military.
But you all had mothers.
Of course we did. Of course we did. And I never had this problem because all of the women I were close to and got to know, they and married and whatever, they were feminists. And so I was a feminist fairly early on, but I think I was a feminist from the influence of my parents because they were essentially feminists mm-hmm. as well. And even though, you know, their dad was a primary money maker and mom was primarily the homebody.
Mm-hmm.
But and in the Second World War, you know, then it kind of broke down a lot of those barriers.
Right.
And it didn't, there weren't barriers in our home, but my mom did, she cooked school lunches and did a lot of work. And Dad was on long shifts, so it was hard because we didn't have much time to see him.
Right.
And he was working night shift for, and he was getting good pay, and we needed it badly because we had this house that the mortgage, and we were just getting our feet on the ground at the depression, and that was a good thing. And of course, the same happened with the GI Bill for me. I mean, I probably would never have gone to college if that hadn't happened.
Yeah. So this Association of University Professors sounds a little bit like a beginnings of a union-type organization.
Yeah, it was, but more it was fighting for giving the faculty a stronger voice in the administration of the university.
Well, that's kind of, because I assume at the time there was not a union for the faculty.
No, there was no union for the faculty, and at that time most faculty would say we don't want a unit, but we do want to have a voice in the administration. We want a Senate, a real Senate, and that didn't happen for a while. And some of the people that are on the faculty council, I mean, they were just wonderful people from language professors and Walt Benish and others. And, there's this one deal where I got into trouble, but I stood my ground. And what it was when in the English department, there had been two, I think they were both in the English department, two that had been hired, two women and one man, separately, had been hired separately, and they were just too modern, and one of them had published something that was already published, gone to the printer before they took the position, in which they use language that that their department head didn't approve of at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that department head became dean. He was, that guy head of journalism for a while.
I don't know.
He was a writer, but he was ardent. He was, I kind of liked him for a while. and he was an ardent hunter, trophy hunter.
I don't know enough of the history of the university
to know names. But at any rate, he was kind of a rising star, and the president of the university system, Bill Wood, liked him a lot. And so it was like, he was his hatchet man if somebody needed to go. Well, these two people, they were given termination notices, and when wasn't explained exactly, they had committed some terrible offense, and they said, well, what was it? And they said, well, informally, that it was we don't like the language you're using, and you're teaching these young people. They shouldn't be exposed to this kind of
stuff. So it was a moral issue almost.
Yeah. And they came to the Association of University Professors when I was president of the chapter and asked if we would consider their situation. And, I said, I'll meet with the others and we'll decide, but I think that's what we should do. And so we had a hearing with them, and or maybe even before we had a hearing with them, it leaked out into the press, the news miner, I think, in some way. I don't know who did it. Probably them. And that they were being fired, and they were not told what they were being fired for. So then news miner, gave it some attention. And so then the dean wrote this letter explaining that... And he did not, he would not define what the problem was, and nor would, he sort of implied they could committed some heinous crime, but that they were being fired for that. And yet he wouldn't define what it was. And so he wrote this letter, and we took this up in the deal, and we said, well, we have to write a counter to that, because that obviously you can't just arbitrarily fire someone. You've got to have a reason, and that reason has to be stated publicly if you're going to arbitrarily fire someone. So I guess I was responsible for composing it mostly, but then signing it, they said, well, you sign first. So I signed first, and everybody else signed. And it was obvious to, the reason for me signing first was because I was not employed directly.
Well, and you were the president of the chapter, right, at the time?
Yeah, but we're a democratic organization, and much more so than the university. So, but it was understood that I was also a federal employee and not an employee directly of the university. So I was left then with going to Bill Wood. We submitted this letter that's saying, criticizing the dean for the terrible wording of this thing that, if you're going to, if this is a heinous crime, then it should be, there should be a grievance committee reviewing the situation within the university system. And there wasn't. And so how can you advertise this? And do you arbitrarily define the crime? What is it? And he hadn't, he kind of weaseled out the whole thing. And and then he ended by saying, so when we submitted this, we were criticizing that. And so he then responded again, the letter to the editor, and we were friends before this. And he said, you, and he was referring to the whole group, this organization, you were sullying his name. I responded to that right away. I said, oh, wait a second, let's get this straight. Who's sullying whose name? If you're making a charge and you're not defining it? So then I had taken, what's that called? Is that the Borelau Winery? I think it was. Ned's.
No.
At any rate,
I can't hear it. I have headphones on.
Hear it?
Sounds like a dog.
No.
All I hear is what sounds like a dog, but maybe it's the same thing. And I just don't know what I'm hearing.
Have you heard Borelau?
I have, but... Yeah. And I know Ned has one in his owl box.
He has a whole bunch of them, because they're younger.
Yeah.
They're getting a bit full size, almost. But anyway...
Anyway, so this fight with this dean...
So I had to go to the president, and with this first, and saying that before we put anything went to the newspaper, and said that, that this was unacceptable, this was before it got out in the paper. Unacceptable to do this without making, you can't just charge someone with a crime without defining what the crime is. And, there was a long list of people that signed this. He was polite, but just barely.
And who was the president? Oh, Wood, that was
Bill
right.
Wood. And then this thing went up with the dean, and And that when that got out in the paper, then, and I was had a chance to respond to him, then I was, you know, in fact, defending these two people, which I was...
I heard it now, yeah.
I was, in fact, you know, defending them, but I was defending their name, because you can't just arbitrarily dismiss people and say they committed a crime. If they committed a crime, you got to come out with it.
So you were defending the principle of all of it. Yeah.
Now, if you don't want that to be exposed to the news miner, then you do have a grievance section with a fairly composed in the, within the university system, and they didn't do that.
Yeah, because there are some you know, quote-unquote crimes that you... are private, you wouldn't want to make public, and the people who committed them wouldn't want you to make them public.
Exactly. Well, they didn't, those people didn't want it to come public, because then they would have a hard time getting a job someplace else.
But in this case, they hadn't actually committed a crime, so to speak.
No, they hadn't committed the crime, but they were crime in the eyes of Bill Wood and the dean.
And the dean, we can't remember this dean's name.
And they could, you know, then if it applies someplace else, and it's not defined, and but it's written that don't hire these people.
They, right.
Yeah, it's, any rate.
So you fought for that and got in trouble?
I vaguely knew this one woman, that one woman who was fired, and she stayed here, and... then I got to know her a little better indirectly through community programs, and she's, you know, she'd been a terrific person in the program.
And so you said you don't remember the dean's name. Do you remember those two people, their names?
No. Oh. I have some of this correspondence in my file in the office.
But so...
Well, we don't want that in there.
Well, it's just an interesting that you... Because you were involved in this organization, you then got involved in these issues, and you kind of were putting your own reputation on the line.
The final thing that relative to all of that was then Bill Wood, and Brian Kessel told me this. He was the department head. He had a meeting with the department heads, or with her probably. He wanted to see about getting Klein transferred.
Right.
Because he's a troublemaker or something like that. And I was still an assistant professor then, and Bryna was very supportive of me, and so she told me afterwards that when he suggested that, she said, "Well, look, Klein has just been doing a wonderful job as unit leader and as a faculty member through the unit. But you don't have to worry about him. He's going on sabbatical to Norway for a year, and he's going to be out of it, totally out of the campus politics. And he won't have to worry about him. And he's just doing such a terrific job, et cetera," something like that. So I respected her.
Well, it was a good thing you went on sabbatical, maybe.
Yeah, but so then...
Let it all die down.
Then when, as soon as I came back, it had died down, of course, and she put my name in for advancement to associate professor, and because she didn't dare do it before that.
Right.
And that went through without any trouble. And Bill Wood became civil with me afterwards, and I gave a... He didn't like me because I was opposed to I was pointing to all the problems with the pipeline and oil development. And it was all based mainly on caribou. And I gave a talk once down at the Pioneer Park. There was two or three of us spoke about some of these problems, and he was in the audience. And then there were questions, and I remember one of the questions he put to me was, "Well, I can't understand why the caribou don't under the pipeline or something, and there was all this funny stuff coming out in the media, and why a pipeline is going to extract. Look, they go all the way, and Don Young was saying the same thing. You know, they go over Brooks Range, and that's so many thousand feet high. They should be able to get over a 4-foot pipeline. That was early on when they were just going to lay it on the ground, and so he asked me, and I said, well, that's a good question, but that's, if caribou could communicate, we could probably get an answer. But I don't, we're studying and we try to interpret what we're doing, but we're not, can't say how caribou are going to, he said, you know, if they're, I had said, yeah, if you get a caribou running fast enough, it probably would jump over the pipeline. But
he probably
they're
like
not jumpers,
answer.
Usually. If they're antelope, yeah, they can handle it.
And it's not like there's traction on the pipe that they could
well, there are
boost
all these
themselves
things
over.
Coming out, and there was the president, I forget who the president was at that time, saying that the pipeline is, well, that was probably the first Bush saying the pipeline is going to be warm. They just cozy up to it. And
or was
in the wintertime.
It might have been Reagan.
Yeah, it might have been Reagan. Yeah.
Sounds like something he would have said.
Right.
One more question, sort of university administratively. We've kind of gotten off track, but I find it's interesting. So there was this Association of University Professors, which was an outside group, but you mentioned this Faculty Council, which I assume is the precursor to the current Faculty Senate.
Yeah.
And so what did your Faculty Council do?
The council would deal with questions the way Bill Wood saw it was he would, you know, say, this is what I'm planning to do, and I need to talk about this, and I'd like to hear about it. And so we would sometimes make a strong case for not doing it the way he wanted to do it, and then present that to him as findings of the council. And his response would be, well, thanks a lot. That's helpful. He'd go on and do his own thing. So we didn't have any authority other than to just advise the president, and he didn't respond to this. And it was like what we just joke, it was a sandbox for the faculty to keep them happy. Mm-hmm. But when we get together, we were getting in some excellent philosophical discussions, and some of them included, well, how can we improve things under these conditions? And we did come out with some strong deals that, you know, this, we're wasting our time if we want. And we were bringing up issues which he hadn't hoped on that. He hoped that we would just deal with things that he fed to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we brought up other issues.
Like what kind of issues did you guys bring up?
Any kind of. One was, you know, we didn't agree that the faculty, let alone students, but we didn't dwell on the student part, should be asked to, should be required to attend the religious ceremonies at graduation.
Oh, I didn't
with
know.
With your cloak and gown, you had to go through this thing. And some of us would not do it and didn't, but they didn't enforce it. But it said, you know, this implied this would may affect your advancement.
Huh. I didn't realize that they had a religious ceremony with graduation.
Well, we got rid of it. But it took us a while. And we said, in effect, you know, this is a state-run university. And even in the private universities, you don't force people to do these things, to go to chapel and things like that. You may... If it's a church university, and then they act like they were he was acting, you know.
Yeah. So, interesting. And what was? Can you think
and
of,
then we we won that one, and then we felt that the students shouldn't be required to go. If they want to have it and their parents want them to have it, and they can have it with it, and if their parents are there and want to be it, that's fine, but it's separate from the university system in the graduation. And so, you know, and then there were some of the other ones. I forget exactly what they were. But
well, we were talking about the whole tenure system. So did that faculty council, when you were involved, push for some changes so this tenure system came about?
Yeah.
Was that happening while you were involved?
This helped with being, that's where the Association of University Professors could play a help, because pretty helpful, because they would give us data on other universities and the state universities, progress being made in this direction, and, you know, what it was that caused them to change. And so it was obvious that we were an outlier, becoming an outlier in Podunk U. And I felt good about that organization, and so did most of the other people. And
you mean the council or the association or both?
I meant both. But no, I felt about the council. I felt good about it. The faculty council was something that we had to do what we could through it, because at least we could provide information to the president, and this is what the council had discussed, and we voted on it, or were you unanimous, or what? And, you know, well, if it's unanimous, I mean, he would not necessarily do what we things the way we suggested, but it had influence on him.
So what years did you serve on that council? Do you remember?
No, I'd have to go back and...
Was it when you first started, or it kind of took a while?
Oh, it took a while.
Yeah.
And part of the unique situation was that, as leader of the wildlife unit, the unit is a kind of entity of its own, even though we were affiliated with the Department of Biology and Wildlife. And we're bringing in money to the university system to support students, et cetera. And we had an office and all of that, and we were part of the university. That was agreed upon. So the institute directors, research institute directors, and deans, I think, met once a month or something with the president. He called the meetings. So I was, as a head of the wildlife unit, as many institute, I was legitimately a member of that, and that had been apparently agreed upon. At first I didn't understand it, but maybe it was just, it started out with just directors of the institute, so heads of institutes, and that included small ones, but they came on later, like social sciences and stuff. Well, for a while there was, forget who the director was, that they were sitting in on that before they moved to Anchorage. So it was good for me, because I was youngest one in the crowd probably, and I learned a lot. And the vice president, who was sort of, he was the vice president for academic affairs or something like that. But he was the only vice president. And there were a couple of them who were really good, that they were sort of with us, but they pointed out they were under the control of the president. And all they could do was maybe say a few good words for the council if we came up with a proposal or idea. And the president would have to explain why he wouldn't go along with this, which was usually, oh, well, it's political, or we'd have to go to the regents, or it would be exchange funding and we can't afford that, et cetera. You know, he'd come up with some denial kind of a explanation. But he was forced to do that at times. And so those vice presidents were, some of them were people I know pretty well, like this, I can't remember these names. The guy who's no longer alive, but he had been president of a small university in Maine, but he had been here in agriculture.
My problem is I don't know all those.
Okay.
I don't know all these names.
Anyway,
either,
his daughter—he's no longer alive. His daughter, and he left a lot of money to the community as well. And so they created a special deal for that supports schools and education and stuff. I'll think of his
name.
I had known him from when I was first here, and he was in agriculture, and I was sort of, and I liked him, but he was really, he'd listen to you and give you good advice, but he wasn't that much older than I was when I came back and became unit leader, and then a couple of times I went to him because I wanted advice. And I got into a bind with somebody who was not, he was with the Arctic Health Research Lab down on Fort Rainred, I think. And they were putting on the annual Arctic Division Science Conference, which I had been, you take your turn, you know, helping organizing it. And so there was some guy down there who was a PhD, and he was a little guy, and he was giving this responsibility, and he behaved as a little guy, and I was responsible for getting things organized for one of the sessions, and I had the people lined up. But I wasn't moving as fast as he was, he thought. And so he literally said, you know, here he was, not part of the system or anything, and he set deadlines, and I said, wait a second, look, I'm working on this, and it takes time, because people can't make a commitment instantaneously, and I realized that you have to pull the whole thing together. But I will, I'll work on this. And then he came back again with short days later and said, this is unacceptable. You have to move ahead at my pace. And I said, whoa, wait just a second. This whole thing, don't we have a committee? We should sit down with a committee if we're going to have deadlines. And no, I have the authority. I'm overall responsible. I said, look, I'll try to speed up, but I've got a full-time job here, and it'll fit in. I just can't drop everything for this. And so then he pitched to, I think, the president or somebody, and So then I went and talked to this vice president about the situation. He said, well, if I were you, I'd just resign from the committee that you can't work with them and explain why and just formally resign. He said, you know, that's the kind of a person that it'll be a defunct situation if he goes on that way. And I did that. And on his advice, and the guy, of course, was pissed, and then it turned out that these people that had already lined up they came to me and said, who is these people that had lined up? And I said, yeah, they're all ready to go. And but they, some of them hadn't made a full commitment yet and told who they were. And, yeah, go ahead. And I'm sure they would follow through. And they did, and they pulled this thing off. And this guy, you know, the committee mostly took over after that deal and put this guy back in his place. But I hate to resign in a controversy. That's, I'd like to stick it out, but I was in that position that he was, you know, threatening this, the conference had threatened it by the way he was behaving.
Right.
Anyway.
Well, it does sound like you've got yourself into a few controversies. You said you hate to resign in controversy. So far, we've been talking about quite a number of...
Well, I got in a lot of controversies with the oil industry, but I tried to avoid the controversy. I mean, I tried to I tried to focus on minimizing impact and where I didn't see that they could do it, I wanted to be straightforward and say, it's not going to work. And so then I remember Chuck, what was his name, who was the dean in engineering, his wife used to be with the admissions, and I'll think of his name. But at any rate, he was a good guy, but, you know, he made these stupid statements like, why do these goddamn biologists have to be involved in planning for the pipeline? I mean, it's engineers that are involved and necessary here. And yeah, the oil industry is far better capable of designing pipeline that'll work for caribou or something than movements and a bunch of biologists that go up there and they're getting being paid big bucks and it's like a vacation for them to go up there. And it was like, biologists don't have a role to play. And he was a good guy. And then I came back at him, and he realized he shouldn't have said that. I said, well, that's an engineer's perspective. Now do you want to hear the biologist's perspective?
Well, it does sound like, yeah, you stick to your guns or you're going to fight for something you believe in. Whether it's fair hiring
well, yes
or...
Yes and no, but on the other hand, I had to be super careful. For example, I didn't want to be labeled as an environmental activist because, you know, there was these Sierra Club, you know, and others that were... we were getting funding from them, from the Sierra Club Foundation. And I says, I'm not a member of Sierra Club. I didn't want to be because of the fact that I'd be labeled. I was a member of the Northern Alaska Environmental Center
and the Alaska Conservation Society.
National Audubon and other organizations, but I never wanted to speak out as a member of those. I would provide information to them and let them go with it and say in the background, if we had good research findings and could use that, I'd provide that information and bring that out, but I'm not going to bring it out. So I was working for the federal government and the university and trying to be objective as a teacher as well and a good role model and doing good science. So there were times when I had to drag my feet. And there were times when the oil industry had BP. There was a British guy that was really top-notch guy, and I was working well with him, and he, you know, helping him minimize impact on oil field development on Caribou, and then he approached me later on, and after we dealt with some of these issues, and said, the oil industry has a position, a biologist position coming up, then we think you would be, you know, a good biologist for the oil industry, and we could, you work well with us, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, well, yeah. And he was sort of implied much bigger salary than I was getting. And I said, oh, that's different. I mean, you know, my job, this education is a major role, and that's what I'm doing, and I want to stick to it. And I'm doing, as I'm still able to be a good scientist, and I want to stick to that. And so I don't see any long-term career goal that would be favorable to me in the oil industry.
And so you're concerned about being labeled as an environmental activist. You thought that could potentially affect your job. Is that why?
Or
your research funding? Or?
Well, in many ways. For example, when these things were controversial, especially the oil field, sometimes it was the federal administration was all for minimizing any obstructions as it is the case now. we want the development to get on and don't hold it up and think of the jobs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And well, under the delay that I argued for to be able to carry out the studies necessary to do a better design for the pipeline, environmental groups jumped on that. And then the secretary that was Udall, the Secretary of the Interior, mm-hmm. and he was the one that then put a moratorium on any state selection of lands, and they had to, he said, this has to be decided by Congress, and that included the native land settlement, so you can get the pipeline route. But they used the argument too that included ours. The pipeline company doesn't know how they're going to design this, and they don't know how to deal with permafrost. And equally, we don't know fully how to design a place. And so the oil industry and the pipeline consortium, then they figured, well, it's okay, we'll chip in to do some of this, speed up they said they'd do this rig a simulated pipeline with, and that stage they were thinking about gravel ramp, buried it in gravel ramps. They could go over mm-hmm. in sections, and then other places elevating it. And they used big culverting, and they built this simulated pipeline up there in the Prudhoe Bay oil field. And they used lakes to make it. They wouldn't swim the lakes to make this thing go about 2 miles long. And then at a PhD student, they built a tower, observation tower, and the PhD student was up there with a scope and counting caribou that would use, when the caribou would come, how many would go over a gravel ramp versus under the elevated pipeline versus where deflected.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was still subjective in many ways, in that it depended on how the caribou were approaching it, depended on the group size, sex and age ratio, and we're collecting all that kind of data. And so you had to wait for the caribou, of course, to be in the area. And when the insects were harassing them versus when they were not, and all of these variables, and we were measuring and but in getting into this study, the pipeline company was going to, we were drawing up a contract with them, mm-hmm. and I forget, it was like 60 or 70,000 bucks, and they were providing, they were building the pipeline, et cetera, but we were doing the study, but they said in the contract that we couldn't release any data to the public without their approval. And so we couldn't publish any reports if we had findings of significance from a given study period without going through them. And I said, no, we can't agree to that kind of a contract. And so we were, said the data, while it's still being collected, it's okay to keep it, but it's our data, and you shouldn't have it until we submit it to you. And if and when we submit it to you, it has to be open to the public, too. And they said, well, no, we can't agree to that. And so then I went to the Fish and Wildlife Service and my supervisors, and I said, you know, we can probably overcome this because if you, Fish and Wildlife Service will kick in $10,000, then federal law says this information has to be open to the public. And so then the next meeting I had with them, I said, well, we've got, Fish and Wildlife Service is willing to contribute to this too, and it's, you know, we recognize that it's a costly project, and we really appreciate that. And it's, there's some real advantage to having them involved in it too, because it's not a simple thing. And we're just the university and the co-op unit. It should be the other either state or federal government involved too. And I didn't mention this. And then they said, well, yeah, you made a good point. And I said, then we'll have to change this wording here because obviously it, under the federal, any information collected through the federal system is going to be open for public access. And, they went along with it finally. But then they violated the rule right away because we're still collecting data, and they have a so-called biologist, which is a senior guy from Canada who had done a lot of waterfowl work, but he wasn't a scientist at all. And he was hired just sort of as, you know, a placer there, as that they had a biologist looking at things. Well, the media contacted the oil industry and said, we want to come up and take some pictures in the oil field. And they said, well, only if you're, you know, people are with you. And they wanted, they heard about this caribou study. And so no reason why they shouldn't be able to take pictures of it. And so my student was up there in the tower, and his guys came, and this biologist came up there and said they wanted to take pictures. And then they interviewed him, and he wouldn't just say too much because they were just getting started. And mm-hmm. there had been some caribou going over the pipeline and some not. And so I don't know whether he said everything, what they were finding, but this, in the interviewing the oil industry biologist, he said, oh yeah, and we're seeing that these crossings are working because, you know, 25% of them are going over the ramp and 15% are going under the thing. And he didn't mention the ones that were deflected because he saw it as a study where this was the difference between the two types of crossings. It wasn't that, that was only part of it. And so the student told me that this is a bummer. And so then I contacted the oil industry and I said, well, this is violating our information, our agreement that we wouldn't release this while we're collecting the information. then the after he had pretty much completed the study, and we had a lot of data, and he was submitting reports to oil industry and to us, the Fish and Wildlife Service, then there was a conference in Canada on animal behavior, and so the student wanted to know about submitting a paper there, or I probably asked him whether he wanted to do, and yeah, so he went to the conference to, and he showed this open preliminary data, and you know, and sent a copy to the oil industry, and they contacted the student and said, no, the lawyers say you can't do that, and so he contacted me, and I then went to the university lawyers, and I said, explain the whole thing, and no, they have no basis for that. I already broke the contract, and it was published in the media that they had released this information, but it was preliminary, and this is not preliminary, and it's been submitted to you, and you didn't review in time for it to stop the... And it wasn't... You made no comments. You just went immediately to your lawyers and said, you can't do it. Mm-hmm. So... And it's already open information, and so they backed off, and he gave his paper and got some coverage.
So I said, it sounds like you not wanting to be labeled an environmental activist was wanting to be neutral as a federal employee. There could have been a conflict of interest, or you wanted to get money from everybody.
Basically, I wanted to be thought of as a scientist, mm-hmm. a legitimate scientist, and then, I was with the university and the co-op unit, et cetera, and working with students, but not doing the things for any particular organization. Mm-hmm. We accepted a contract to do some mapping of the care from the Sierra Club Foundation. That would have been a big grant, a big amount of money given to them. And so we did some first satellite imagery to map caribou habitat for the Western Arctic herd, wintering range habitat. And it was beyond my area of expertise, but I learned a lot, and the students... Pat Valkenburg was involved in that, doing quite a bit of the flying, because we had to ground truth what the satellite stuff was showing. And it was a good contribution to knowledge at that stage, but it was just the beginning, and it needed a lot of refinement. And it ultimately now is starting to happen, but it was in advance, too, of the quality of the technology to some extent. So,
I want to just get back a little bit to what we were talking about before, about the Cooperative Wildlife Unit and their relationship with the other faculty. So when you started in 1962, how big was the cooperative unit? Were you its only employee, and then everybody else was faculty?
When I started... there was only the only faculty member was me, mm-hmm. and there was no assistant unit leader, and there was one secretary, and that was it. And then as time went on, they approved nationwide having assistant unit leaders, so there would be two people. An assistant leader would eventually could take over if the faculty member transferred or retired, mm-hmm. or what have you. Which it was a good concept, and that was a good. So then I had assistant leaders, and I had three assistant leaders. Peter Lent was the first one. He had done some caribou work during the Cape Thompson studies, mm-hmm. and he was a student here as well as at another university, Canadian University, I think, Alberta. But he worked closely with Bill Pruitt when he was in the field there, mm-hmm. and did really good work with the caribou before we hired him, and then hired him. He was a good. He took on advising students and became, you know, he was a faculty member, just like I was, and we had adjacent offices, and we worked well together, and it was took some of the burden on me, and meant I could do things like take a sabbatical leave. Mm-hmm. And or something like that. But there was no money for sabbatical leaves.
Right.
But I could take time off and go do research someplace else, which mm-hmm. was good for me, and I felt it was good in the long run. I would be better and a wildlife leader.
And then, so by the time, you know, when you retired 30 years later, the unit grew and was bigger, or was it still
No, then I'll have to check on the dates on this. Then sometime in the 80s, it was either the late 70s or early 80s that the fishery unit started.
Right, okay.
As a separate unit, and I'll have to get this book out and see if that's covered in there too. But we could get that from the present unit.
Yeah,
I think.
I'm sure they have that.
And then there was a fishery unit leader and a fishery assistant unit leader. Now, they were a separate unit. And by this time, we had the Institute of Arctic Biology had been created, and we were both, our budgets were handled up there.
Your wildlife unit's budget was handled by IAB.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that released, I mean, the unit leaders had a responsibility in developing it, but the money went directly into the IAB business office.
Oh, so you didn't have to manage it quite as much.
Right. Although my secretary was doing a lot of that, and sometimes there were disagreements between the woman upstairs and her and how they operated. And I could see that because their personalities were totally different. And so that by this time, Bob White has become the director of IAB, and he and I got along very well. Originally from Australia, he could be a very tough guy, and sometimes and bow his top, and you had to get to understand him, and I did pretty well, and then we worked together and supported one another, and he was satisfied with their business woman, and I was satisfied with what I was doing, but I realized it wasn't working very well. And so both of us were trying to smooth over this relationship. And we managed, and both of them were good people. And sometimes that happens. You know, they're both women, and they just didn't click well. But we managed to get them to work together enough so that we got by pretty well. So
But so the cooperative, the wildlife unit always was sort of just an administrative. You didn't end up having, you know, 10 faculty under you who were employed by the union.
No. But now it's expanded even further because not just one assistant unit leader. You can have several. Oh. Well, part of it is because it's now a cooperative fish and wildlife research unit. So there were that provided more options for additional people. And so now the unit has hired a young scientist, and they, in the wildlife unit, how many, I think the, in both fish, there must be about not just two assistant unit leaders, but about five assistant unit leaders for the two, the merged unit.
And each of those assistant leaders also teach and advise students?
Yes, and they have more laid on them for teaching because they don't have the same administrative responsibilities as the leaders.
And it's very confusing to understand how this wildlife research unit integrates with a biology and wildlife department.
Well, it doesn't. It could have been, for example, in land use and natural resources. But that came along later. Mm-hmm. Because there wasn't. They were all within the biology and wildlife originally. And in fact, there wasn't. They didn't have forestry or land use planning they've got outdoor recreation and things like that. Those didn't exist.
So I'm just trying to figure out how this unit integrated and worked with this biology and wildlife department and how everybody interacted and what the responsibilities were and how all the faculty got along. And
a lot of this integration and I'm not being modest now, was on my shoulders as a unit leader and is now on the shoulders of the unit leader. And that must have been in the 80s when the fishing unit, late 80s, 87 I think, but I'm not sure. Then in the 90s, that was 80, about 87 when that two units merged, mm-hmm. I think, but I'm not sure. Can't remember. And then I was offered to be the unit leader for the whole thing, and I said, no, I don't want it. I don't want administration. I want to focus on research.
That's when you became senior scientist.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. But yeah, anyway, it is a confusing situation of how this all operates on a day-to-day basis.
It definitely is, and it, unfortunately, at times, chancellor or deans and what didn't understand this. When they moved into the positions, they didn't. They just thought we were just part of the biology. Mm-hmm. And there were times when at the dean's level, they'd have to have a budget cut, and because of less funding available, and so the only thing they could cut was the salary for the secretary, and they couldn't cut that because of the cooperative agreement. So explaining all that, we had this one woman chancellor from Oklahoma, and she was pretty good in some ways. But she was had to face with budget cut across campus, and someone, I thought, you know, we can't cut, and we don't have much money coming from the state through the university system, and hasn't increased substantially, and we haven't hired more people, and we can't just lay off people. And so I had to go down. She was having a campus-wide deal of all of the department heads, and it was open to faculty, and I went down to the the student union building in that place and meeting, and she wanted to do it, you know, fairly formally. And when I had signed up and when it came to my position, I had to go and explain all this at the cooperative unit. And so, and finally she said, well, I see you, I can understand your point, and I guess we have to agree to stay with what we have. And I said, you know, you're still, I mean, you're not cutting, the federal isn't cutting the positions, and we're still carrying on and carrying heavy load and advising students and stuff, and we plan to do that. And sometimes that load may get heavier if you're cutting back on the biology and biology program, but we're committed to working with them, with the university. And so then the dean at that time was very supportive, and so he sort of said, yeah, that's the way it is. It's very complicated. And I said, that we'll dig out copies of the cooperative agreement and make them available to you so you have this. And she finally ended up thanking me, and she said she understood the situation. But, you know, I dreaded that because that took me about 2 days to go down something that had been agreed upon, and I thought people understood it, and then had to go down through it again, and you have to prepare yourself
right.
for that.
And you say each new dean, you had to start over again.
Sort of, yeah.
Well, and as I say, you know, it is confusing. So how would you characterize what you said, you know, you had teaching responsibilities, you had student advising responsibilities. So how was what you were doing different than the faculty in the department?
How would I do what is it again?
So as an employee of the wildlife unit, you taught, you advised students, you did research, all three things that a faculty member in the department did. So what did you do that was different from a regular faculty position? You managed a research budget? Is that?
Oh, I put for the unit. I developed it with, yeah, and managed it. And I went out and lobbied to get it from mainly federal agencies like Fish and Wildlife Anchorage office, wildlife refuges, Forest Service, and you know, I had to keep my ear to what might be available and build up a relationship with all of them. And so I did. I had Forest Research Lab in Juneau. I had a good relationship on deer ecology and had students working there. And then he approached me when he had new studies and wondered if the unit worked through the unit. And I did that with BLM and Park Service and others. And so, yeah, they paid off definitely. And I enjoyed those connections because they were people I respected that I was working with. Some of them I'd known for a long time and some not at all first. And then they were all areas of within my interest from the standpoint of understanding ecological systems and their management and research. So it was what I was interested in doing, but also realized that it tied in with all of the teaching and everything, and especially my interaction with the students. And if a student is then funded by one of those agencies, then often I would have one of them on their committee.
So it sounds like you were sort of helping to set a research agenda, going and finding the money to fund those research projects and getting students involved in those research projects, whereas a faculty person just did their own thing. You had a bigger picture.
Right.
Okay.
So, and sometimes we did, when the two units were separate, we would agree to go down to Anchorage and put on a deal with the fishery people talking and the wildlife people talking and explaining what areas of expertise we had and trying to establish good contacts for future.
Well, yeah, so you were sort of an outlet for federal agency research projects.
Yeah, right.
That they couldn't do in-house. You kind of were the contractor, basically. Yeah. I'm trying to just understand it.
I think I now understand. Yeah.
After
good.
3 hours.
You're one of the few people probably on the system.
Well, that's, I understand it, for 1962.
I know.
1992 or 2012 or 2014, it's a whole different story, I'm sure.
So one of the key changes that occurred, and occurred within the whole university system in terms of research and teaching, is that there was gradually a pressure. I don't know whether the regents were involved, but I don't know of why are some of these research institutes doing all this good research, and yet the university teaching isn't benefiting from it. And so, you know, there's nationwide, there's been this attitude developing in the sciences that good teachers and good researchers are synonymous. Well, it's not always the case, but it's a good point that a good researcher can be an outstanding teacher and vice versa. And for the most part, that is true. And so that's why teaching and research are important components in evaluation and mm-hmm. advancement, and that's what we want. And public service, too, but it's mainly that. And so that meant that I could play a supportive role in all of that, but that the there was pressure from coming down from the regents and through the chancellor and through the deans, that we want to make better use of the research people and get them, in many cases, twin split appointments. Well, we were in the biological sciences. We were the first to really do this and make it work. It was because we had a good program, but it was more than that. It was the core program. The core courses had to be taught, and biology is one of them. Whereas only in physics department where there's things that we could, where they could, a few of the geophysical institutes could be involved, yet most of them, for their budgeting, you know, they would ask for more university money, and they said, well, but your faculty aren't doing, only a few of them are doing the teaching. Whereas in the biosciences, it worked well.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a new structure created in the biosciences called the Division of Life Sciences. When that happened, that was then the Institute of Arctic Biology, which had existed as a separate institute, they were a key player within the Division of Life Sciences, as well as the Department of Biology and Wildlife. Mm-hmm. And the co-op unit went into that program too. So we then became more connected with the IAB.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made sense. It made sense for the other faculty, because then they were getting longer commitments and support. And it was easier for them to get research coverage for at least some of the summer,
mm-hmm.
As well as teaching. And they could buy out easily if they got grants coming in. So that to me was a major step and a very positive one, and we became sort of a role model for the other institutes that kind of resented it in a way, but because they were dragging their feet. But that was the wave of the future, and for marine science and geophysics and IARC and all of those, I mean, it's the way it should be. It's still very difficult where, like IARC, where they got, you know, Japanese people. And they're right now just...
They've just pulled out.
They've pulled out, and yeah. They've got big problems.
Right, and I would say that not... Just because somebody's a researcher does not necessarily mean they are a good teacher.
Of course. And we've had problems with that.
Yeah. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So, but
one of our best teachers, I won't mention the name, a researcher, he kept getting these poor evaluations from the students. And finally, he was a bit... egocentric, and he was doing such wonderful research and pulling in all this good money, and he volunteered to teach at the upper division level, but it's not the same when you got to cover a broader field than the specific one he was in. So then he was. He was at a meeting with the department head and institute director, and, you know, how can we help you do a better job and better, you know, when it comes to review for advancement? And his attitude was, well, he wasn't all that interested in advancement because he was being recognized for his outstanding research.
Right. He didn't care about the teaching part.
So they suggested, well, why don't you try teaching an introductory course for non-science students, conservation in general. He said, oh, well, okay, I'll give it a try. Oh, man, he connected right away with these. Because he was really experienced out in the field and what, and understood native cultures and all of it. He just loved it, and they loved him. So that, and then he wanted to teach those kind of courses again, and that worked out well, finally.
Mm-hmm. Well, my pen has run out of ink.
Uh-oh.
So I think that's a sign that maybe we should stop for the evening.
The battery is not quite, but almost.
The battery, we were plugged. We don't have to worry about batteries, but okay. My pen has failed me. So perhaps we should end, but I do want to kind of wrap up with one last question, which is about the relationships with these department faculty and the wildlife unit. Because you were from different structures and different perspectives, were there problems with people interacting?
There were early on, but right now I think it's pretty damn good.
And well, when you were in charge, what did you do to overcome those problems? How did you handle that?
The problems were not the kind that should be resolved by department head rather than by the wildlife unit. Because sometimes faculty, and some of it related to salaries, you know.
You mentioned the 9 month versus the 12 month.
But even the salaries for wildlife unit leaders were tied to the federal budget, and that went up and down the same with the state, but they weren't always in synchrony.
Oh, and you were in a different merit system, so your salary increases were probably on a different scale and schedule as well.
Well, yeah. And if your performance was superior, you got within the merit system, then you could your advisors would try to advance you accordingly. And I was fortunate that it was happening. And sometimes, you know, mostly the faculty didn't know your salary and you didn't know theirs. except I knew it because it was more open what the salary was for assistant right. associate. There were times when we got the Quapian people nationally got the support of the Wildlife Management Institute to lobby Congress to get more money so that we were being paid mm-hmm. salaries that were at least comparable to university level.
Right.
Before that, we were under them.
Oh.
Then that happened, and we gradually got higher. So they were... then there was some resentment. Mm-hmm. But I never... that wasn't... as long as I was being paid reasonably well... that's one thing. I just didn't want to go there and wasn't interested and never envious of other people, mm-hmm. even though, you know, top scientists in the, some universities, you know, their salary is almost unlimited.
Right. What were some examples of other problems that the faculty?
The problem was that from my perspective, was the graduate level. That's where my students were. That's where I was teaching when I did teach. And yet, I had to lobby the department head and insisted a little bit when it came to course offerings for our program. And that it was hard for faculty to teach at the graduate level because there was no incentive within the academic unit for them to teach a course at the graduate level. So literally, they were volunteering. I mean, they didn't get a salary increase for taking on an additional course because they had certain core courses that they had to teach. For some of them who were primary teaching, it's hard to ask them to teach the graduate level, and then if you're recruiting new faculty and you don't, now you can do it more because it's a split appointment. But and if they're in research, you can get a graduate course out of them that may, when there's certain courses you got to have, and I couldn't teach them all.
Mm-hmm. But there was a graduate program in wildlife management at the time, right? When you were unit leader?
Oh, definitely, but...
So who was teaching those graduate courses? Just the regular biology department wasn't teaching in that program?
I'd say that was a problem. Some faculty didn't...
That's interesting. But, you know, you set up a graduate program. Of course, you have faculty who teach in it, right?
Yeah, that's the problem, though, because there should be a certain... For a long time, there was no budget to the Department of Biology and Wildlife for graduate courses.
Even though they set up a graduate program.
Yeah, so technically, if there was... Huh. If they absorbed this with some of their contingency money. If you wanted to do a field course, for example, and I would get, if I was doing it, I would try to get money through the co-op unit. And I had a small budget, but I could maybe get some if things looked good at the federal level. But at other times, no. And the university, we had our own vehicle for a while, our vehicle. We had more than one, but mainly one. And the station wagon, and, you know, I could use that, and that's when we kept our own budget and everything. But then the university didn't like that. All vehicles should be under their system, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. Well, that was okay, but then when we needed them, then they had to pay for them. Well, the department... now, some of these field courses I offered, the best I could get was some gas money, but I did, you know, boat trips and things like that. sometimes on when we went to Southeast Alaska, they told us the students right up there we were going to have to pay for their ferry ticket, and we all chip in for the food costs, and we prepare our own food as much as possible. And that, I like that system, and the students didn't mind it. And they frequently got, if they had a meal ticket, they could get food from the to take with us from the for on their meal ticket. And so I had to do a lot of these extra things. And then, you know, like these field trips were usually the most popular courses. And I, you know, you could only take 10 to 12 students. And I tried to get, and sometimes, occasionally, a faculty member would say, you know, you're so damn lucky you get this most popular course that's offered. And I would say, you know, if it didn't fill up with graduate students, then we'd take senior level students. And it was always full. And we squeezed in one van, if possible, sometimes two vehicles. And then, because I had these connections from the past, I frequently could shame the Fish and Wildlife Service into taking us out on their boat. And that costs big bucks. They got a budget, too. And, you know, I made the case that, you know, these students are maybe future employees, but they should know what the Fish and Wildlife Service does, and this is no better way. And did the same with Fish and Game, and sometimes Forest Service people. And that took a lot of coordination on my part and a lot of leaning on people that I have known for a long time. And they would say, but yeah, we have a limited budget this year for the boat. But once they came through, then that was great. And of course, that made these trips wonderful.
Right.
And that was wonderful for all of us. And then I could get some of the biologists to go out with us. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't just me. And that was terrific. I mean, it strengthened the relationship between these Fish and Game in the unit, and Fish and Wildlife in the unit, and Forest Service in the unit. And I was building these contacts, and that's where it was easy to get funding.
When that other faculty said, oh, you know, just you've got this great course with these students, did you say, well, you know, you could teach one?
And I sometimes took another faculty along with me, say, would you come on this? And some did. And they mostly appreciated, but there was a couple that were saying, yeah, I'd like to go, but I'd like to go. And then I'd say, okay, next year I'm going to sign you up. And when it got close, then they'd say, I can't get away. Well, they didn't give it a priority, and they didn't plan. But they knew in advance, and that's the worst case, because then you're left with a place, and is there someone else available to go instead of them? But part of it, too, was there was a lot of planning and contacts, and that took a lot of my time, but I perhaps, you know, enjoyed doing that because these were people I knew, but I enjoyed putting the whole thing together, and then I enjoyed being out and seeing it work.
Well, yeah, it's a whole different type of thing than giving a lecture every week in a classroom here on campus, and other faculty maybe weren't as interested in putting all that time in, versus it's easy to teach a basic class in a lecture hall.
One course I would teach every other year or something was, we called it grazing ecology. It was herbivory, really. And so that was good. Students gave talks, wrote papers, and reviewed other papers, and we gave I usually would ask at least two other faculties to be with me on team teaching, mm-hmm. or regular faculty who I respected, like Bob White or Steve McLean or Terry Chapin. And so they would, I'd say, if you agree, then each of you are going to have to make one of the introductory talks as well as me. But then you want to be there when the students, and so you can comment on the students, because they would cover fields that included their field. Well, most of them agreed, and the ones that did, they enjoyed it very much. But it was tough because they had to fit that time in, and they realize you get more out of it if you participate. But you have to be the type that don't try to hog the time, but be there to contribute when it's appropriate, and especially for students. And we had quite a few foreign students from Scandinavia coming, and then we'd do this one field trip on a weekend down to Cantwell in the late winter, where we could ski out. Sometimes people would, I'd say, okay, snowstorms, if you really weren't skiers, but you had to have one or the other. And then we would generally luck out on the weather and could stay in this cabin all together, mm-hmm. cook, all volunteer, you know, you're working with the students and help, you know, do things. And then you could talk in the evenings, and we even had the sauna there next door that we could use. And with, you know, some of the skiing when you're out was a little bit recreational if the conditions were just right. But it was amazing, you know, you go out there and you know, well, what's herbivory? Well, let's first get the spotting toads out. And there's moose up there on this hillside that you wouldn't see unless you look for them, and what kind of vegetation they're in. And then we'd get up skiing, and we'd get into areas where moose were either present or had been, and we'd try and do the same with caribou, see where they're crating, ptarmigan, porcupine. They were all out there doing their things, and snowshoe hares, and it was, you know, how are these, and it was winter, you know, how can they get by, and all of these different creatures out there, which, you know, we'd see some of them, but sometimes we only saw the droppings and the tracks, and you learn what you can from that, right. And then caribou thing, we often had a visiting Scandinavian biologist in, who was, I mean, and they were usually characters, and it was fun. Like one guy from Sweden who was an expert on reindeer range in northern Sweden, and I had been up and visited with him and been in the field with him, so I knew him well. And he was kind of big belly, he liked beer, but he was a powerful guy. He was a good skier, and he used wider skis, the Swedes, but he got around well. And we go out in the field, and he would demonstrate, you know, this snow measuring deals. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time we were in the cabin the night before, and he said, this is what we're going to go do out in the field. And he got this thing, and he says, if there's a layer of ice, and he says, I'll show you how it works. And he reached over, and he probably had bought this as a contribution to the food, these round Scandinavian hybrid.
Oh, right, cracker kind of bread, yeah.
And he takes one of these and sets it down there, and he says, now you... if it's a crust, you bring this thing down and the thing shattered, you know. And that's what he wanted to happen. And he said, see how it happened? So it was down there picking these things up.
That was dinner. Wait a minute.
It really got the across right away.
Right.
And they're out skiing. I mean, there's this one very attractive, he was very attracted to women, young women, but a woman was doing some, just getting started on a reindeer study with land resource management, and she was game, though, and she was just getting started on skis, and so she was slow, and we were raking trails, so it was easy for the people coming later. But this Swede always stayed at the very end. She'd fall over, he'd down there, pick her up, set her down. So okay, give her advice, and she'd go on. And so she loved it, and so did he. And, you know, by the end of the weekend, I mean, she was doing fairly well, but it was just a wonderful kind of guy to have along. And he, you know, all the time he was explaining things, and she says, now, you know, you dig a crater in the snow. He said, now put your nose down in there. What does it smell like? Well, they'd all say, it smells like mushrooms. Well, that's because lichens are part fungus, and that's what you're smelling. That's what the caribou smell.
Cool.
And they can smell through the snow.
Well, I think we should stop for this evening. It's getting late. And I think next time we can talk more about the courses and your relationship with students, and because I know that's really important to you.
Right. Yep. Okay.
Great. Thank you.